The Midweek Drive Team, four words which signify quality and all that's best in audio entertainment.
Well, still to come on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition, we'll be looking at how artificial intelligence is impacting not only the 75th anniversary of the NHS, but also, and perhaps even more significantly, how it needs to be embraced by our teachers in schools as well as students. But before we come to that, somebody I can guarantee is not a ChatGPT, even though it has been suggested that we might apply to that in the near future. And with another Tipperary tale, it's the awesome Jenny Finch. How are you, Jenny?
I'm fine, Alex. Nice to be here.
Well, away you go with another edition of Tipperary Tales.
Hello, everybody. This episode is from June last year, June 2022. Yes, it's heading for summer, but here in Mid-Ireland, flaming June is quite frankly flaming awful. I know Ireland has a reputation for bad weather, but this year it's been all over the place. January, for example, was very nice, sunny, mild, and promising the earliest of early springs. We were ready to enjoy it. Colin, our redoubtable postman, soon crushed our enthusiasm. A warm January always means a cold and stormy few months to follow, he said gloomily. He was right, but even he didn't predict this flaming awful June. A lot of it is down to Storm Alex that sent high winds and cold showers across us for a couple of days before the storm itself hit. Since then, we've had 10 days of storm force winds, icy rain, and sudden short bursts of tantalising sun. We've still got the heating on morning and evening, and actually lit the fire a couple of nights. Here's hoping it turns into flaming June soon. Everything is growing, of course, and we've been waiting for our wild flower bed to burst into life. It did, putting forth what we hoped was the first of our 60 irises. Alas, we got one. One beautiful but solitary flower in a sea of unidentified leaves. A few more flowers have poked their heads out in the last few days, including some lovely poppies, but they appear to be surrounded by some sort of wheat or corn. I suspect this is due to the bird feeder. Maybe it wasn't a good idea putting the bed just underneath it. Still, we may be growing some of our own bird seed for next year. We have had some problems with deliveries despite the nice new road, although that only reaches halfway along. The rest is still a farm track. After waiting in all day for a courier, we received a message saying they called, but there was no one home. We spent several minutes stamping around the house, muttering and cursing. Apparently the parcel, due by 8:52 a.m, was back at the other end of the county by 9:22, which is total nonsense. Jackie sent a furious and scathing reply, as all delivery men use the air code and sat navs generally with no problem. Without it, we're almost impossible to find. When we calmed down, we decided it was perhaps a good thing nobody could hear us. They might send the men in white coats to take us away as mentally deranged, though they probably wouldn't be able to find us unless we sent them the air code. We had a lot of fun imagining the phone call. Can we have your air code, please? No. Ah, come on, we can't find you without it. Absolutely no. Don't be difficult now. We're paid by results and we're below our quota for this month. Goodbye. One good thing about the flaming awful June should be I've had no excuse for not getting on with my writing, but this has become a dispiriting exercise recently. My publisher has been very ill, and in a small firm, this makes progress extremely slow. I signed the contract for A Long Shadow, Alex Hastings 5, 14 months ago, but there has been no progress at all since then. There is an 18-month deadline on the exploitation of rights, but I don't want to evoke it yet. So I'm stuck, unable to write book 6, as I don't know what will happen to book 5 or the others. There's no publicity, and book 4 isn't linked to the series on Amazon. This is despite requesting it and the relisting of the ebook over a year ago. It's rather depressing as I feel all my work is just fading away. After a long talk with Jackie, I came up with a new strategy. Some of you may know I have Irish relatives, the Coonies from around Cork. They include a cousin, Jem, who's a bit of a writer and a dog lover. We've swapped stories and shared experiences, and together come up with an idea for a new book, maybe several books. As I am already published and have more experience, I am doing a lot of the writing and editing, but will publish under his name with me. I know there is sometimes resistance to writers swapping genres from some readers, and I do hope to return to Alex Hastings soon. This arrangement allows Jem's stories to get out there, and there is a bit of a mystery crime element to the books, especially if we get to do the second one. So there we are, still toddling along. I've pulled my shoulder again and can't use this trimmer. You can almost hear the nettles sniggering with delight. Little do they know, I have acquired a weed burner, and as soon as the wind dies down, I'll be out there to settle their hash. I don't think I should try it in this weather. I'd probably burn down the wood. That would really make it a flaming awful June. As we wait for jobs to be completed, we've been making good use of our time. We hoped to get the grass cut using the mower, but alas, it refused to start. After calling the mechanics, "We'll be up to you soonish," we picked away at the grass and weeds. Jackie wielded the strimmer and I cut back some of the ever-growing thistles and nettles. I've also been weeding the wild flower bed, removing the corn, and we've been rewarded with a growing number of poppies. Definitely a good use of our time. As the nearest largest town is about 15 miles away, we tend to do several things on one trip. Shopping, of course, and trips to the recycling centre. Sometimes we combine the bank, the fishmonger, and the doctor, though not necessarily in that order. This week, we finally got around to joining the library, taking a set of my books in as a gift. I have to say how impressed I am with the public library system in Ireland. The staff are all extremely welcoming. Joining was a doddle as I have my Irish driving licence with me, and the range of services astonished me. First off, I can borrow up to 12 books for 3 weeks. There are no fines for late returns, though they do send increasingly sad texts as a reminder. Then I learned I could use any library in the Republic with my card. Away on holiday somewhere? No problem. Just borrow some books, and if you're not finished, you can return them to any library on your return home. Wow. Other services are equally impressive. I can request any book in any library from the catalogue and collect it from the branch of my choice. I sometimes use the interlibrary loan scheme in the UK, but with little success. The wait was often very long, and frequently the books never arrived. Here it is a truly joined up service, and now my books are available to every reader in Ireland. That's not all. I can remotely borrow both ebooks and audiobooks on my ticket using a PIN number. I can also download and read newspapers from across the world, and, if I ever wanted to, magazines. And it's all free. There were young people inside the new light building, reading, taking notes, and using the computers. There are special holiday groups covering story reading, writing, and even Lego figures inspired by favourite books. There's a volunteer group who visit housebound relatives and deliver books or read to them. That is really what a library service should be. Just around the corner from the library is a primary school. And driving past, we spotted a beautiful wooden carving of two owls looking down into the playground. A lot of trees were lost in the high winds last year, and rather than just chopping them down, these have been transformed As we drive around exploring the little roads that radiate out from town, we've seen some lovely things. On the way home from shopping, we have encountered a very old man who has planted the verges and hedgerows around his house. The result is beautiful. Flowers, bushes, and contrasting hedges run on both sides of the road. Whenever we see him, we stop and exchange greetings. The first time we told him how much we liked his work. "Them's kind words," he said. "Well, that is kind work he does, and certainly time well spent." As we drove past this week, I thought of my father, a passionate and highly skilled gardener. I could see him doing something like this. We are fighting a seemingly endless fight against the sticky willow to the south and bindweed to the north of the house. Sticky Willy has crept or blown into Betsy's corner, and we had to put scaffolding boards across the back to reach the overgrown parts. They will suffocate some of the bigger plants, though we may lose a few bulbs too. Still, it's looking a lot better now. I need to keep on top of the problem, as left for even a few days, it's all back again. A small amount of time spent on that can save a lot of weeding. So we're moving forward, despite the inevitable delays in getting stuff finished. We now have Irish number plates for the bikes, though not crash helmets. These necessitate a trip to Limerick, alas. We have all the meters and most of the infrastructure for the pump system safe in the Majestic, and the meters are ticking away merrily. The guest room upstairs is finally taking shape, and we still have time to read, to draw, and to write. Our days are full, but we feel more rested now after the last few frantic years. Above all, we have more choices. We are certainly making good use of our time.
There we are, another top Tipperary tale. Them's good works. Although I must admit, it did sound, Jenny, as though you were channeling your inner West Country person as opposed to a Tipperary soul, but never mind.
That's what he sounds like. That's what Eddie sounds like.
Well, there we are. The West Country hits Ireland. And clearly you're impressed with the library service there. It won't last, surely.
Oh, it's magnificent. It's wonderful. Had no trouble with it whatsoever.
Well, obviously in Britain, we're looking to replace everything, as we said, by chat generative programming systems or indeed transformers. So that's the next line. Another Tipperary tale in the near future?
Absolutely. If you'll have me, I'll be here.
Seems like only yesterday we were celebrating the 50th anniversary of the NHS with all manner of wonderful things happening. But that was last century. That was the 20th century. And we obviously are in the 21st as we approach the 75th anniversary of the NHS. And how is it going to develop as the years go by? Well, 7 in 10 NHS workers believe that artificial intelligence could help significantly reduce patient waiting times. Flip side of that, of course, might mean that there's no place for the medics of the future, or maybe they'll become computerized robots as well. To actually address this, we're delighted to welcome two fabulous individuals. First of all, Chief Executive Officer and founder of Florence, and indeed former NHS doctor. That's Dr. Charles Armitage. How are you, Charles?
Hello, very well, thank you.
Excellent. And we've also got distinguished futurist Tracy Follows. How are you, Tracy?
Very well, thank you, Alex.
Excellent. Tracy, if we can come to you first, because clearly, in the immortal words of Leonard Bones McCoy, I know engineers, they just love to change things. Now, that was in the fictional Star Trek universe, in which obviously doctors were still present, but they had all manner of wonderful things that they were using to scan systems, whole body scans and so on, some of which have started beginning to appear in our particular timeline. But what are your own thoughts in terms of how artificial intelligence in particular can be utilised to benefit both the patient and arguably the organisation that is the NHS?
Yes, it's a great question. And I think in a way it goes back to the trends that we were looking at for why would we want to anticipate what lies ahead for the NHS 75 years ahead? And it is because we have some really distinctive trends that are colliding that are going to create a kind of very different environment to the one we're in now. So for example, we've got an aging population. We know that people are getting much, much older and taking up a bigger proportion of the total population. population. So obviously that has an effect on not only the patients and the types of things you're looking at for the patient and what you need to diagnose and treat them for, but also on the age of the workers who are having to who are working with the patients and looking after them. We've got more autonomy in the workforce, so we've got flexibility, we've got hybrid working, we've got people thinking about, you know, Monday to Thursday is the work week and Friday to Sunday is the as the weekend now, and in some ways the rest of the industry and sectors are catching up with the NHS, who have been working on shifts for a long time. And then thirdly, we've got technology, which is filling in some of the gaps that are going to become apparent there with working in these flexible ways and also looking after a sort of more elderly population overall. And those technologies are doing connectivity, interconnectivity, sharing data rather than maintaining it in a siloed fashion. And that's going to completely overturn what we're used to, I think, as patients and as healthcare workers in the NHS. And so what we really wanted to look at was, what does that mean? How are we going to solve the health and social staffing crises going forward? What will those staffing crises be? And AI was one of the possible solutions to this, because what we found was that obviously, AI has already been used and is working to some extent in a healthcare setting. But actually, is it going to be a sort of co-pilot, a collaborator, almost a colleague for particularly nurses, but also social care workers in these healthcare environments? And actually, we looked at some of the ways this might manifest. And actually, we found that also NHS healthcare workers felt the same, that they expected it to happen. Not only will AI be able to do the like efficient things like reduce patient waiting times, but it might be able to help with diagnostics, synthesize lots of data, do some analysis, and actually help on the diagnostics alongside a healthcare worker who's working in that environment.
Charles, a few years ago, I was speaking to the nephew of Nye Bevan, who, of course, founded the NHS amongst many things he actually was involved with. And it's fair to say that his nephew, Lou Bevan, actually pointed out that the NHS in the year 2010, I think it was then, would have been unrecognisable for what was originally set up, obviously, back in the 1940s. What has just been described by Tracy in some ways would be seen to be another huge leap forward. But is this something which you're comfortable with, or is it a case of you thinking, well, I don't know, we're just going to have to see where this artificial intelligence is taking us?
I mean, I think it's a very astute point that the NHS, when it was founded 75 years ago, was built to deliver care for a fundamentally different population, a fundamentally different environment. People back then tended to live shorter lives with less complex chronic illness and had single system disease, so much more common for someone to have a heart attack and die rather than now survive and live longer with increasing potentially care needs. So the NHS now is completely different to what it looked like 75 years ago, and it's going to be completely different to what it looks like in 75 years time. One thing that we do know is that in order to drive that change and be able to deliver care to a changing population, the healthcare workforce needs to be able to change with it. And what that means is that frontline healthcare workers need to, rather than be afraid of technology or scared of what it's going to do to disrupt their jobs, which jobs will change, but they will continue to exist. You know, we work in a world at the moment where all of the narrative is around there being a shortage of healthcare workers and an inability for people to spend the time they need to spend with patients. Surely, if we can build tools and practices and processes and systems that help people be more efficient and deliver more care to patients, that can only be a good thing. You know, Tracy was talking about the demographic changes that we're facing as a society. And if we don't adopt new ways of delivering care and embrace technology, then we're going to be in a really, really challenging situation in 10, 20, or even 75 years' time.
Well, we certainly would hope that the NHS doesn't have a do not resuscitate sign put upon it by artificial intelligence making a mistake. But let's talk very briefly, Charles, about your own company, Florence, of course. Presumably that's not an acronym. It is actually named after the great Florence Nightingale.
It is well spotted, Alex. Yes. So we at Florence, we're a healthcare technology company. And what we're doing is we're setting out to help solve the NHS's social care staffing crisis. And the core thing of what we do is we help frontline healthcare workers, nurses and healthcare assistants find and work flexible shifts. And what we can do by doing that is help healthcare systems and healthcare organizations deliver really high quality care to patients. And we've conducted this research at Florence, where we've spoken to hundreds of frontline healthcare workers and asked them what they think the future of the healthcare system looks like. And the results are really astounding. And if you want to find out more, you can head to our website. It's on the homepage of our website, florence.co.uk. You can read our future of healthcare report for what the NHS is going to look like in 75 years' time.
And Tracy, nearly half NHS workers anticipate the possibility of doctors becoming extinct by 2098. Some people might say, well, that's a great thing, but we need more bureaucratic people actually made extinct before they actually go on to doctors. As somebody who's very much, your career is focused on predicting the future, and you're the founder and chief executive officer, obviously, of Future Made. Is that something which fills you with joy, or is it a case of we need to find some way not only of adapting, but also ensuring that the AI interface is one which is symbiotic as opposed to parasitic?
Yes, exactly. I think this is definitely more about the replacement of tasks than the replacement of positions and people, if you like. But I think what it's reflecting, and that is a high percentage, 48% of healthcare workers saying they expect doctors to be extinct. I was actually really surprised it was that high, but I'm not surprised if we look at some of the reasons behind that, because I guess what we're seeing is a recognition that there are caring aspects to the role of doctors and nurses and other healthcare workers. It's very empathetic, very focused on the patient and the human needs, but that can now be used in tandem or exist in tandem with, you know, really amazing, powerful AI diagnostics, analysis, all of this other stuff. And actually, it's a collaboration between the most caring in the healthcare sector and the most analytic. And perhaps when you put those two together, you've got a very powerful force that kind of transcends doctors, if you like, and becomes something else. And if you think about how personalized our medicine is going to be in 75 years' time, how tailored it's going to be to the actual individual patient, not just some kind of generic patient or case, then I think you can understand perhaps why people are saying that the general practitioner might be replaced by something much more personalized, tailored, and a kind of fusing of, you know, nursing and AI. It could be the perfect combination in the future.
And Charles, is there an equivalent of an artificial intelligence Hippocratic oath that actually operates on the basis of, first of all, do no harm, primo non nocere?
That's a really relevant question. I think there are a lot of people around the world trying to sort that one out at the moment. There are significant and real concerns, I think, about what the potential future of artificial intelligence could be, and creating and building benevolence as a core component of any models that are built is 100% essential. I think what we probably lack a little bit at the moment is a regulatory landscape, whether that's within the UK or Europe or globally, around how we ensure that these really powerful technologies are being used for good and not for harm.
Well, to quote the old Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. We certainly do seem to be living in interesting times. Can you just remind us, Charles, where people can go to find more detail about the report, which we've alluded to today, the Future of Healthcare Report?
Sure thing, Alex. They can head to the internet and go to www.florence.co.uk, and there on our homepage is a link to the Future of Healthcare Report, what the NHS is going to look like in 75 years' time.
And Tracy, as you're in the top 50 female futurists in the world in Forbes, where can people actually follow yourself?
Oh, you can go to tracyfollows.com or Future Made Consulting. Thank you very much.
Tracy Follows, futurist extraordinaire, and Dr. Charles Armitage, CEO and founder of Florence. Huge thanks. And may the future always be bright and positive.
Thanks, Alex.
Chat GPT, AI, all challenges which certainly are impacting on education. We've talked at length about this across the airwaves with folk in higher education and beyond. But what about the whole notion of teachers? Well, there are a number of strategies that can be adapted with respect to ChatGPT. Some tutors actually prefer to get their students to generate an essay and then comment on the essay itself. Well, we have two people to actually talk about this particular aspect. First of all, digital safeguarding consultants. That's Charlotte Ainsley. How are you, Charlotte?
Hi.
Excellent. And we've also got educational technology specialist and former head teacher, Mel Parker. How are you, Mel?
Hello. Good, thank you.
Excellent. Mel, In many ways, this is the science fiction nightmare writ large. We believe that we can make progress. There's a demand about artificial intelligence. And yet, literally, as I've done myself, you can actually put in a sequence of aspects into ChatGPT and you get a whole essay put together. So, you know, clearly smarter students or even mid-range students are saying, well, why not just do this then? So how do we cope?
Well, I think actually we fall back on the professionalism of our teachers. We know if a student is working at a grade 3, for instance, in a subject and then suddenly hands in an essay that's a grade 7, the teacher will spot that and will ask them, what is it? You know, how did you get to this response? Tell me a little bit more about this. And quite often students will then actually just back down and tell you that they've actually used something like an AI tool. As a maths teacher, if I asked them to do work without a calculator, I could soon tell if they they'd used a calculator at home to do things. So actually it's down to the professionalism of the teacher, and the teachers just need to know and be supported in looking for the advice.
Well, this is of course the critical thing, because obviously the algorithms get more and more complex, more and more sophisticated and so on. And is it not a case of, as has often been said, if you're using calculators back in the day, people would say we don't use that. So isn't this just another variation? And we need to effectively evolve our programs, our educational programs, to be fit for purpose, rather than effectively saying, well, if you don't do your rote memory, you can't actually progress.
And that's very much it. It's also similar with the invention of the internet, you know, 34 years ago. Look at what the internet is doing now in the classroom, but also out in the world of business and the way we all work and live our lives, really. So if we shut it down and say and try and think it's not there, that isn't the way forward, really. I think it's about embracing it, but also thinking about how they regulate it, because that side of it is really important as well.
Over 40% of teachers believe it's their responsibility to monitor students' safe use of AI in school. Charlotte, this is really focusing on yourself as a digital safeguarding consultant. It can be a dangerous world in the virtual space of aspects that people can pull up on. And how can folk effectively monitor that what sites are being accessed and so on? And indeed, AI that's developed isn't simply a case of malware or indeed various other mischievous ways of actually hacking into lives and various other aspects?
I mean, schools are mandated to use both filtering and monitoring software to help to protect children from risks in the classroom. Of course, what we don't want to do is mitigate the risk so much that children don't have any kind of experiences. And it's really important that teachers teach young people about how to use these tools effectively and teach them about the pitfalls and the advantages of this kind of technology, because going forward there will be an expectation that they use this kind of technology. So it's absolutely crucial that they understand both the risks and the opportunities.
Mel, as a former head teacher, is this something that you're glad you never had to deal with in terms of the potential challenges that you've been faced with staff having this side of things? Or is it just a case of, well, it's okay, it's just another developmental aspect of the whole pedagogical process?
I think it's probably a bit of both. It's supporting staff because they will not have the familiarity, but also I think it's embracing it. And I think in terms of staff well-being, there's a lot in the press about the workload of staff. AI brings in opportunities to support them in trying to cut that workload. And I think it's just finding the best ways of use. And I think we're at the very early stages of it. In my role at RM, I work with head teachers in trusts across the country. And, you know, it's simple things like, you know, writing a letter to a parent about attendance of a student, not necessarily getting the full letter, but getting some themes really quickly and then being able to personalise that letter for a parent. But that's just a tiny example of what you could do with it. I think the only thing we're limited by is actually our own creativity about asking the right questions of it.
Charlotte, let's go back to digital safeguarding. If we're looking at inappropriate access and inappropriate use of AI, I mean, one of the findings that has been headlining in recent times is that 20% of students admit to using AI to access inappropriate content. So that's a fifth of students effectively accessing inappropriate content through AI. Now, students are inevitably going to be mischievous, problematic from that point of view. How serious is that problem?
I think what we do know is that where, for example, there are the creation of deep fakes, so the use of perhaps a child's head on somebody else's body, children are particularly affected by that kind of use of technology. And they tell us that it's just as bad as if it was you in reality. So again, we need to make sure that in terms of regulation of AI, it is completely transparent about what is an AI image and what isn't an AI image, so that everybody can start to differentiate, because the harms can be really significant. And I think, you know, in terms of children's mental health, and again, we've heard a lot about this over the last few years, particularly with COVID, there is an increased pressure on children and young people to look a certain way, and the use of AI again can be misused in that way. So it's really important that we integrate the messages into the teaching and learning around not just AI per se, but safe and responsible use and critical thinking use of the internet and being online.
So you've raised a number of interesting moral points there, Charlotte. I mean, let's turn back to Mel. I mean, Mel, are you overall optimistic about the future? Do you feel as though it's a scary place? Do you think as though actually we need to work around measures with respect to that? Because, again, on an international front, the general narrative seems to be that Britain's falling behind when it comes to AI in general.
I think the potential is for a scary future, but actually with proper regulation, then actually the future could be really innovative and exciting. And so I'm hopeful for the future.
Okay. And any suggestion in terms of where you point people, parents and teachers, in terms of finding steps that they could actually take in terms of improving their skill set when it comes to AI?
So in terms of that you've got the Safer Internet Centre website, but also on our website, rm.com/education, you would be able to find some hints and tips and also to get in touch.
And Charlotte, as far as digital safeguarding is concerned, anything you'd like to add to that in terms of what is out there?
I think it's crucial that we rein this in now. We don't want to end up in the same situation that we are in with social media, where we're trying to kind of row back and protect children in a way where, you know, we've created these sites and services that weren't necessarily designed for children. So I'd certainly like to see government taking a really proactive role in regulating this area before it's too late.
Mm. Interesting times, although I can hopefully say and confirm that neither Charlotte nor indeed Mel are ChatGPTs, and I don't think I am myself as yet, but you never know. Charlotte Ainsley, digital safeguarding consultant, and Mel Parker, educational technology specialist and former head teacher. Many thanks indeed.
Thank you.
Force a coin and you're there again.
Now, we often talk in many ways about scanning ahead, scanning the horizon, looking for challenges, and then hopefully preventing them before they actually become major issues. And certainly that applies when it comes to health as well, specifically if you're looking at cholesterol levels. They may not have been as popular these days as they once were, but they still can have a massive impact in terms of our general health and well-being, specifically if you've actually suffered a cardiovascular event, such as a heart attack or indeed stroke. And to talk us through some of the important aspects of keeping on top of those cholesterol levels, we're delighted to welcome our ACE Media Medic extraordinaire. It's Dr. Sarah Jarvis. How are you, Sarah?
I'm always better for talking to you, Alex.
Well, thank you, Sarah. And likewise, it's actually the positivity continues ever onwards. But this particular survey and research from Novartis Pharmaceuticals, a lot of us are kind of really not paying attention to our cholesterol levels, really. And it's not going to bode well for the future, is it?
No, it isn't. You're quite right. So this was, as you say, a survey from Novartis Pharmaceuticals UK, and they have highlighted a really quite scary lack of understanding about cholesterol, particularly in older people. Now, everyone, I think, needs to be aware of their cholesterol. Of course, there is an inherited form of high cholesterol, which means you're at much higher risk of heart attack and stroke, and that does affect younger people in particular. But really, my view is that anyone who's over 40 who hasn't had the cholesterol checked really does need to be thinking about it. And very worryingly, in this survey, nearly two-thirds of people had never worried about their cholesterol. And these are people over 55, despite the fact that, unfortunately, no matter how much we try to avoid it, getting older, the march of time, does mean you're at higher risk of heart attack and stroke.
Absolutely. Now, in terms of actually checking those levels, how easy is it to get done? Because I think it's gotten easier over the years, really. You may not
it definitely has.
An appointment. Yes.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So if you're 40, 74 and you haven't already had a heart attack or stroke, then you are eligible every 5 years for a free NHS health check. And that will include a cholesterol check. But really, really importantly, if you have had a heart attack or stroke, you should be seeing your healthcare professional at least once a year, more if they say to tell you to come in, because it's so important to check your cholesterol levels, to take the medication. If you've had a heart attack and stroke, obviously you're going to need to make lifestyle changes. Everybody should be thinking about lifestyle changes. But if you have had a heart attack and stroke, you're going to need medication as well, because your risk is significantly higher if you've already had a heart attack or stroke. And we really, really need to help you to improve your cholesterol levels, to manage your lifestyle factors, and therefore to cut your chance of having another one.
We've spoken many times over the years about the importance of nutrition, Sarah. That obviously is key to cholesterol levels and so on. But this doesn't have to be hugely taxing. I mean, there can be simple changes that you can adopt, presumably, just to actually keep reducing the cholesterol intake.
Oh, absolutely. So it's actually not to do so much with your cholesterol intake. It's mostly to do with a combination of things. The first is your weight. If you're living with obesity or overweight, then even losing a few pounds can make a real difference, can reduce your bad cholesterol, can help increase your good cholesterol. Regular exercise can also make a real difference. But actually, what's in your diet as well? Unfortunately, it's all too easy. We live in a world where we're surrounded by food that's high in saturated fat, that is high in refined carbs, so starchy carbs and sugary carbs, and all of those things can contribute to putting on weight, and of course, really importantly, can contribute to higher levels of cholesterol. So you don't need to make enormous differences, as you so rightly say, Alex. Little tweaks to your diet, little adjustments, reducing the saturated fat in your diet, but really importantly, you know, even among over 55s, nearly two-thirds had never worried about the cholesterol levels. Now, if you're not worried about your cholesterol level, if you don't know what your cholesterol level is, of course, you're not going to have the same incentive to do anything about it. So really important that people do something about it. More than three quarters of people, in fact, nearly four in five people said they didn't know that high cholesterol doesn't cause any symptoms in the short term. That means unless you do know your numbers, then unfortunately you will have no idea that your cholesterol could be raised. And, you know, this can be a ticking time bomb. all the time you're living with higher cholesterol, you are living with a higher risk of heart attack and stroke, and particularly if you've already had a heart attack and stroke. Really worryingly, one in 11 people who've already had a heart attack and stroke either hasn't made any changes to their lifestyle to cut the chance, or they haven't had a cholesterol check with someone at their practice since they had their event. Now, you know, it's just so important at least once a year if you've had a heart attack and stroke. We really could make so much change in this country to the number of people who die or indeed have their lives wrecked by heart attack and stroke.
heartuk.org.uk, presumably a good website to check out to find out more details about what we've been discussing today.
Absolutely. So Heart UK is the cholesterol charity, and they have everything you need to know about your cholesterol. Or, of course, you can look on the NHS website, or you can look on patient.info. All of them, lots of information there in easy bite-sized chunks. But you're quite right, Heart UK has some great information about how to bring your cholesterol down, and importantly, what extra steps you need to take if you have had a heart attack or stroke.
Some folk might just say that listening to your dulcet tones, Sarah, is just enough to actually lower that blood pressure slightly, just calm down through the whole process. Maybe we need to actually roll that out in a virtual sense in times to come. But for the moment, Dr. Sarah Jarvis, our GP extraordinaire, and of course, TV doctor, huge thanks, and keep on keeping on.
Pleasure as ever. And you just keep on looking after yourself, Alex. Always a pleasure.
They didn't know where he was going, but they knew where he was, wasn't it?
Of getting home.
More than a quarter of women from minority ethnic backgrounds say that menopause support that they received has not been helpful for them, with more than half of women from Black, Asian and minority ethnic backgrounds say that current advice is focused on the menopause experience of white women. Sobering facts that have recently been unveiled by some research by Holland and Barrett and more. We're delighted to actually speak to two fine souls to actually expand a little bit on this challenge. First of all, from Holland and Barrett, Director of Women's Health there, Lena Chan. How are you, Lena?
Very good. Thank you.
And we've got menopause expert Meera Bogal. How are you, Meera?
Oh, I'm well. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Meera, a really, I say, surprising findings here. I mean, it clearly shows that one size doesn't fit all. And we do have challenges here when it comes to, obviously, how the menopause is being dealt with.
Oh, I mean, you know, it's interesting, Alex, that you say surprising. But for me, it doesn't. It's not surprising at all, because working with the communities that I work with, I hear this a lot. I hear that, you know, South Asian women that I work with, in particular, I work with sort of Hindi, Punjabi, Pakistani women, don't feel part of the conversation at all. They feel very much that the current, as you quoted, the current spotlight is on the experiences of white women, and they feel very excluded from this. So this research is much needed. We need more research. But the actual, you know, the initiative Every Woman, Every Menopause Matters from Holland and Barrett is hugely, hugely important and absolutely groundbreaking, because it is bringing to the forefront that inclusivity and breaking those barriers by having, by having menopause support and advice in four different languages via free consultations, and that's in Hindi, Punjabi, Urdu, and Gujarati. So this is much needed, and I'm super, super excited to be part of this campaign. And that's why I absolutely jumped at the chance to be part of it, because it is really what we need.
Mm. Lena, you're Director of Women's Health at Holland and Barrett. Did this confirm, again, some of the initial feelings you already had about this particular area?
Absolutely. I think menopause and many other women's health conditions, women of a diverse background tend to be less believed. They tend to lack the language to advocate for themselves. So we definitely do see a disparity in menopause and other conditions in kind of how they experience it, but then also how they're able to access help. So it's absolutely important that we continue to break these taboos. We continue to help translate wherever possible, and also, you know, have women there of the same ethnicity talking to them, because it's through that similarity, it's through that connection that you get women talking about something that's already difficult but shouldn't be difficult. And that's what we're hoping to do, is to start normalizing these conversations and breaking and kind of bridging this gap.
Meera, for many years, certainly in terms of British culture, the menopause was something you didn't really speak about. It was sort of put to one side from that perspective. Is this a similar challenge that we're facing in the 21st century with different cultures as well?
Oh, I mean, I think it's across cultures still. But yes, definitely within the ethnic minority communities, there's a huge, huge challenge that we face to make sure that the menopause support and advice that we are giving or we're able to offer is inclusive. And the initiative that Holland and Barrett have launched, that every menopause matters, it's really bridging this gap. It's working towards bridging that gap. I mean, from a personal experience, I suffered for 10 years with perimenopause and symptoms. And these don't, you know, the thing is, I think we think about it as impacting just the woman. But what we forget is that the symptoms that can be there can be so debilitating that women need to make lifestyle changes. They need to think about their diet and their exercise and their health in a much more focused way. But that the impact of menopause affects their husbands or their partners or their work colleagues, their children. It doesn't just impact, that in an isolated way, the woman alone. So actually, we need to make sure that every woman and every person really has that information to hand. So making it available then, you know, in these languages. And I know there's more work to be done, and Holland and Barrett recognise that, but making it available in these languages really begins to start that journey of making women from ethnic minorities feel more included in the conversation and therefore able to actually give, you know, give us more insight into what's going on. Because again, genetically and, you know, within sort of different ethnicities, we experience menopause slightly differently as well. And that's something that I do see as well, working with the women that I do.
Lena, from a cross-cultural perspective, do you feel that Holland and Barrett are at least taking the right steps here, or is there a lot more to be done in terms of this cross-cultural communication?
I mean, I think we're taking the first few steps. There's, again, like Mira said, I think there's a lot more that we can and should be doing. We're really proud of partnering with Wellbeing of Women. So we're launching also as part of this campaign, a Women's Health Community Fund, because we recognize that we can't reach everybody, but we can help accelerate that reach. So we're going to be providing resources, micro donations to people who are already in these communities and kind of just help accelerate that work. Because I think the only way that we start really taking step changes and closing this care gap is if we work together. You know, so we work with the likes of Mira, we work with more grassroots organizations. There's no reason to sit and wait. It's really kind of, you know, how do we think about the small steps that as Holland and Barrett we can take, but then how do we accelerate the communities that are already in there to do more?
And Mira, I'm conscious we're having this conversation in English, which perhaps so many brains would say, well, that's not really reaching your target audience. But where would you actually point people if they are relatives or if they're first, second generation, et cetera, to effectively say, look, there is this help that's actually online that could be of assistance?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that, you know, I wasn't able to do this before. So I am visiting communities in gurdwaras and in temples and wherever, mosques, wherever they'll have me, literally. And I wasn't able to signpost them anywhere. And so having this campaign and having the online hub, which is, you know, where women can access information in four different languages, is absolutely vital. So visiting, and it's so simple. It's as easy as A, visiting one of your local Holland & Barrett stores and popping in and making an appointment. But even easier as well than that is that online, booking an appointment, and you can actually choose the language you want that appointment to be in. So, you know, those four languages, Urdu, Punjabi, Gujarati and Hindi, that in itself is just the start of making women's experience of menopause so much more positive.
Mira Bagal, menopause expert, and Lena Chan, Director of Women's Health at Holland & Barrett. Many thanks indeed, and keep up the excellent work.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.